Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. I'm your host, Chase Dalton. Today, I'm going to be talking about the South China Sea. The South China Sea is one of the most important international waterways in the world. More than $5.3 trillion of shipborne goods traverse the South China Sea every year, with about a trillion of that heading to or from the United States, another trillion inbound or outbound for Europe. If you can, I want you to take a second and look up a map of the South China Sea. But for those of you who are in the car or something, the South China Sea is a 1.4 million square mile area bound by the Vietnamese coastline on the west, the Philippine Islands on the east, the Chinese coast to the north, and Malaysia and Indonesia to the south. Four of the world's leading exporting countries are vitally dependent on the South China Sea for their maritime trade. You have China, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. And these same nations are also vitally dependent on imports that pass through the world's busiest choke point at the Straits of Malacca before turning north through the South China Sea. About 65% of South Korean petroleum imports and 60% of Japanese and Taiwanese petroleum imports pass through the narrow Straits of Malacca on their way to these countries. Before 2015, that number was 80% for China, but beginning in the early 2000s, China looked at the Straits of Malacca and made plans to insulate themselves from a U.S. Navy blockade of this narrow strait in the event of a future war, because this blockade would grind the Chinese economy to a halt. In 2005, China began building two huge pipelines, one for oil and one for gas, from the Bay of Bengal on the coastline of Myanmar, straight through the jungles and the mountains of the country to Yunnan Province in southern China. These pipelines started operating in 2015, and today about 30% of petroleum imports into China pass through these two pipelines, which leaves only about 50% through the narrow straits of Malacca and the South China Sea, which is still a lot, though. China's also been building overland energy connections to Russia to further insulate themselves. And in this respect, the war in Ukraine and the isolation of Russia from the West has been a real boon to China by making Russia even more dependent on Chinese energy buyers and strengthening that oil and gas connection that the two countries share. The South China Sea is also a very, very rich fishing ground. About 12% of the annual worldwide catch comes from the South China Sea, mainly because of the Spratly Islands. And the Spratly Islands are just a very extensive group of more than 100 really small islands and reefs and atolls that are smack dab in the middle of the South China Sea. And these Spratly rocks are tiny, like really tiny. Altogether, they make up a little less than 3 square miles. But these islands are the key to a ton of money, and they are the best way to do power projection in this super vital area of the world. The Spratly atolls and the reefs are where fish spawn and lay their eggs, and so the fishing rights alone are really important. But far more important than the fish are three things. One is energy, two is economic rights, and three are territorial rights. The U.S. Geologic Survey pegs the South China Sea as containing somewhere between 5 and 22 billion barrels of oil, and between 70 and 290 trillion cubic square feet of gas, which is worth just trillions of dollars. And the Chinese government has it pegged at an even higher number. And so, to put it simply, there's a lot of oil, and it's worth a lot of money. And this much energy, beyond just being worth a lot of money, has very important geopolitical national security implications for every country that gets a piece of it. And who gets this energy, and who gets these fishing rights, and who has all the other economic benefits of being in the South China Sea comes down to the economic and territorial rights as governed by international law. In addition to various reefs and super small islands, the South China Sea is dotted with hundreds of these really tiny rocks that barely poke above the water at high tide. And this distinction between being visible at high tide and these rocks being visible at low tide is important, because if at high tide the rocks are visible at all, even just an inch above water, it's considered land, aka claimable territory. Some country can say, this is ours. And this claimable territory lets a country do all sorts of stuff, such as building a military base on it, cough, cough, China, and entitles the controlling country to territorial seas of 12 nautical miles all around the perimeter of this rock. And territorial seas are the type of water that a country has the most control over in the international law. Territorial seas are regarded as the sovereign territory of the state, no different than land that a country owns. And this means unlimited economic rights in the area, but more importantly, that foreign ships and aircraft are only allowed innocent passage through and over this area, and can't take any action that is considered, quote, prejudicial to peace, good order, or security of the coastal state. And so even a tiny speck of rock gives a country pi r squared, or 452 square miles of territorial sea. Multiply that out by hundreds of little rocks, we're talking about something important here. But it's still a fairly limited area. But more than that, if a something could be considered territory, that area extends 200 miles out farther than the edge of the territorial water, and that's a country's exclusive economic zone. And this means that whenever a country controls the exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, under international law, controls all of the fish, all of the oil, all of the gas, and all of the other economic value in that area. So doing some more math again, right, pi r squared, an island can represent a potential 141,196 square miles, or roughly the size of Montana. And now we're talking, not bad for a tiny little island, right? So now you see one of the big reasons that countries fight over tiny, otherwise worthless South China Sea rocks and islands, and why China is currently engaged in a blatantly illegal land grab and intimidation campaign against every other country which claims a part of the South China Sea. And a big part of this push is pushing ahistorical narratives and outright fabrications on the various governing bodies that resolve these sorts of claims. In 2014, China claimed to a Hague tribunal that, quote, Chinese activities in the South China Sea date back more than 2,000 years. China was the first country to discover, name, explore, and exploit the resources of the South China Sea islands, and the first to continuously exercise sovereign power over them, end quote. And literally every single statement in the above is laughably, blatantly false. But this is the truth that Chinese society has been taught, and just like the, quote, fact that Taiwan is no different than any other part of China, it's just any other province, nothing to see here, da-da-da-da-da, right? Like, very false. And one of the linchpins of Chinese claims to the South China Sea is their so-called Nine Dash Lines map, which China submitted to the United Nations in 2009. And this map is basically an internal government map made in 1947 that shows China's territory extending through almost all of the South China Sea. This is sort of the rough equivalent of the United States digging up some old aspirational imperialist map from the archives of the Library of Congress some bureaucrat drew up, showing a line extending around the entire Caribbean, claiming that this entire sea is now U.S. territory. Tough luck, suckers. Countries don't do that, right? It's not how it works. But China's official claim is that the area of the South China Sea within these nine dashed lines, which is, say, virtually all of the South China Sea, is as much Chinese territory as any part of mainland China, despite the lack of, well, of any evidence or presence until very recently to back this up. But since this 1947 map was published, China has been on a semi-literal warpath over its made-up claims. Before World War II, the southernmost territory of China was Hainan Province, which is a pretty big island just south of the Chinese mainland. Not a single Chinese sailor or soldier was stationed in the South China Sea. This has been more or less the case for thousands of years across dozens of Chinese dynasties, because the truth is that the Chinese were never a particularly maritime people and never had a maritime empire, and were, for the most part, pretty content to just receive the occasional tributary gift from people across the sea, and not particularly inclined, with a few very limited exceptions, to do much exploring or colonizing by sea. But post-World War II, the Chinese government has been on a blatantly expansionist kick. They have conquered Tibet, they have fought half a dozen border wars with their neighbors, and still have open a number of unresolved territorial disputes on land over what they see as their rightful borders. Immediately after World War II, those disputes also began to spill out into the South China Sea. This started because during World War II, the Japanese occupied the formerly French-controlled Paracel Islands, which is that other island chain just north of the Spratlys in the South China Sea, a little bit closer to China. And after the Japanese surrendered, the Chinese went in and seized the northern Paracel Islands while the French were still getting their stuff together, and the French retained the southern half of the Paracel Islands as part of their then-Vietnamese colony. China also claimed a former Japanese submarine base near the Philippines in the Spratly Island chain. These seizures were illegal, but they were done during a period of a lot of geopolitical movement post-World War II. The United States had bigger things to worry about than the Soviet Union claiming Eastern Europe. And the Chinese correctly judged that at the time, nobody was eager for World War III just months after World War II ended. when Vietnam became independent, it retained control of the Southern Paracels until 1974, when the Chinese Navy seized the Southern Paracels from a very weak South Vietnamese government right after the U.S. Navy withdrew. And China would then go on to seize the Vietnamese part of the Spratly Island chain in 1988. And there are more disputes going on about island sovereignty to this day. But still, China was not done in the South China Sea. In 1987, China put up a weather radar station on Fiery Cross Reef. UNESCO at the time was conducting a global oceanic survey, and China volunteered. China said, yeah, sure. We'll help UNESCO. We'll put up a weather radar station at Fiery Cross Reef. We'll help. And of course, this help turned out to be a little less than altruistic. The Chinese government then declared that the reef was now their property because they had put up the radar station on it. And at the same time, 1988, China seized Subi Reef from the Philippines, which has since been turned into another massive military base. And they seized Johnson South Reef from the Vietnamese, resulting in a fairly large battle as the Vietnamese attempted to defend their territory. And you can actually go on YouTube today and see early grainy color footage of the Chinese just mowing down Vietnamese sailors and Marines who were in knee-deep water on their reef with anti-aircraft guns. It's pretty horrifying and grim. But it follows the general pattern of how the Chinese acquired their various bases in the Spratly and the Paracel Island chains. In 1995, China seized Mischief Reef from the Philippines. And in 2012, seized Scarborough Shoal from the Philippines. And in 2013, seized Luconia Shoals from Malaysia in the far southern part of the South China Sea. Beginning in 2012, China began to militarize their stolen South China Sea possessions. They began building up these huge land areas on these reefs, these geographical features, and they started adding airstrips and military radar stations, port facilities, barracks, missile launchers, and in short, turning these built-up reefs into fully-fledged military bases throughout the South China Sea. In 2017, China seized Sandy Cay from the Philippines and began building up that feature as well, and I don't necessarily think that the last seizure has happened yet. The net effect of all this expansion means that China is now a very significant threat to every country bordering the South China Sea. China possesses unsinkable aircraft carriers just off the Philippine and Malaysian coastlines, and that makes it a whole lot easier to press the claim, when push comes to shove, that everything within those nine dash lines is Chinese territory. What you gonna do about it, right? And these military bases help China lay claim to the massive fishing and energy stocks they have no real right to. Their bases allow them to threaten to cut off U.S. allies like Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan at will. And this is a disaster that the United States Navy will someday have to deal with in the event of another hot war in the Pacific. But since the Philippines, Vietnam, and Malaysia aren't exactly in a position to go to war with China over a few reefs, they're forced to fight using the law, which at least in theory binds all nations, even the powerful ones. International maritime law is a little weird, that there are written laws like those defining territorial waters as 12 nautical miles from a shoreline and the exclusive economic zone as 200 miles beyond the territorial waterline. But there are also something called customary international laws, which are a little murky and depend a lot on historical assertion and acceptance of certain rights. And so when various nations, which have taken China to international arbitration over the South China Sea claims, China pretty much knows that it has lost on the merit of the cases already and relies a lot on these historical claims to the area. And the thing is that China has no real historical claim to the area either. They have a map with some dashes on it that never really meant anything. And there have been various kingdoms, which are now in, you know, roughly the South China Sea area, which over the centuries have periodically paid some degree of tribute to the Chinese Empire. And there's been one big Chinese explorer, Zheng He, who supposedly sailed to the area 600 years ago. But the fact is that the Chinese claim here is unbelievably weak. Now, I don't mean to say that China is unique in having some historical myths that don't quite get held up by the latest and greatest rigorous historical research. Most countries see their own historical greatness through rose-colored glasses and can look back on some period of history where their nation or their people or a precursor empire of some sort controlled a whole lot more territory and extracted tribute from the weaklings next door. I mean, you know, heck, the United States is far from immune from this effect. And I suspect that if you picked a country at random and magically gave them a population of 1.4 billion people and the world's second largest economy on a clear track to being number one, and the world's second most powerful military, all of which China has today, that this random country would also be inclined to press some dubious and expansive territorial claims. But the fact is that China is the country in that position, and there is a reason none of its neighbors are particularly jazzed about the prospect of having China as the uncontested regional superpower, and are just praying desperately that the United States is able to hold the balancing line for them. Because say what you will about our national historical past, which has its fair share of skeletons and regrets lurking in the closet, we as a country have been pretty darn benign global hegemons over the past couple of decades in a way that China does not seem particularly inclined to replicate. But going back to China's claim, a huge part of it rests on the voyages of the explorer Zheng He. And the historical consensus is very clear that Zheng He never actually saw the Philippines, despite the Chinese claims, as part of their assertion of rights owed to various Philippine islands and reefs. And this is pretty universally accepted as a historical fact outside of China. But even a couple of decades ago, it was accepted by Chinese historians as well, before the issue became politicized in China, and it became sort of an unhealthy position to take. And so to buff up their support for this, China has pretty consistently submitted some falsified and dubiously true evidence to support various tribunals in support of their historical causes and claims, which have not held up particularly well in court. And if we are going by counting ancient territorial claims justification out in the South China Sea, a pretty decent one go to Vietnam via the Champa Kingdom, dating from the 2nd through the 19th centuries. And in fact, that was the oldest ever recorded name given to the South China Sea. It was the Cham Sea. And other decent claims go to the Hindu, and here I'm going to mess up the name, I'm sure, but Majapahit and Srivijaya empires, which are largely based out of modern-day Indonesia, and the Khmer Empire based out of Cambodia, which controlled most of Southeast Asia for a couple of centuries. And there are a couple of Muslim sultanates based out of the Philippines and Malaysia, which controlled various aspects of the South China Sea. And then, of course, you have the Portuguese, the Dutch, the French, the Spanish, and the American empires, all of which held sway over some or all of the South China Sea at various points in the colonial history. And all this isn't to say that China, it's not true that China never sent a ship or had any sort of presence in the South China Sea. But the presence that they did have was very sporadic. It was never very strong. And if we're going by ancient claims of finders keepers, well, just about everybody has a better historical claim to the South China Sea than modern China. And in fact, this is borne by the fact that China has lost tribunals against literally every single country bordering the South China Sea that they have taken territory from. But unfortunately, this does not change the facts on the ground. And the fact is that China is building up bases on other countries' rightful territory. But this does mean that the United States Navy is in a good position to help these countries push back against Chinese expansion. So coming back to the present and the modern legal system, which is a little more complex than an ancient "I saw this rock first," a lot comes down to a remote island called Ituaba. And Ituaba, also known as Taiping Island, is the largest island in the Spratly Island chain and is currently controlled by Taiwan. Of course, that means that mainland China feels free to make territorial claims based on it because they don't recognize Taiwan. And the thing about Ibuata / Taiping Island is that despite it being the biggest island in the Spratly chain, which again sits in the middle of the South China Sea, it's still really tiny. It's only 0.2 square miles. If you look it up on a Google Maps satellite view, you'll see that it's basically a very small oval in the middle of the ocean with a big airstrip right down the middle that takes up the whole length of the tiny island. And then on either side, there's a couple of buildings and two huge desalination plants, which make the only fresh water available on the island. And now one could say that 0.2 square miles is not large enough to sustain human habitation or economic life on its own in the natural condition, which is the key phrase for international law. So basically without the airstrip and the desalination plants. And well, by any definition of that phrase, you are absolutely right. And historically, you'd also be right. But maybe a very small, very hardy group of fishermen could somehow eke out a living on the island in its natural condition. Maybe. And so in these sorts of borderline cases, international law looks at history. And the island has very conclusively never held a permanent human population, ever, as far as the archaeological record can tell. Because again, it's just too darn small and barren to actually support permanent human life. without ferrying supplies to the island constantly. This pretty much closes the case. But as it turns out, since the ability to sustain human life or economic life on its own is an important legal concept in the law of the sea, this is heavily disputed by China, which claims that, in fact, Ibu Ata / Taiping Island can, in fact, support human life all on its own, despite the lack of historical evidence and an international tribunal ruling that says the island cannot support permanent human life. So why is this important again? Well, if an island can support human life all on its own, then the island is granted a 200-mile exclusive economic zone, an EEZ, around it. If it can't support human life on its own, then it only gets that 12-mile territorial sea to the nation that owns it. And because Ibu Ata / Taiping Island is the largest island in the Spratly chain, if that island cannot be designated as able to support human life on its own, none of the other smaller islands can either. Whoops. So there goes a lot of economic claims. Shoot. And so China, despite the evidence to the contrary, has taken the position that Ibu Ata / Taiping can in fact support life on its own, as long as you ignore all the flying, the food, fuel, parts, medicine, literally everything else in the island needs. Nothing is here, folks. And so the so-called 200-mile EEZ around Taiping Island, which, you know, mind you, is controlled by Taiwan, not actual mainland China, China claims that this EEZ overlaps the Philippines EEZ. But China has also declared that they do not consider themselves bound by international arbitration because they keep losing and these sorts of fake claimed overlap cases. So basically, they are claiming other countries' exclusive economic zones and asking them,
"You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?"
And these Chinese claims get even more absurd when you start to look at the smaller islands, these smaller rocks. Because Ibu Ata, again, is the biggest at 0.2 square miles. Scarborough Shoal, which is right next to the Philippines, is a tiny rock that comes out of the ocean at high tide. There is literally no possible way that a human being could live there, much less a stable community of humans. Like, total square feet above water, 50 maybe? It is a wet rock in the middle of the ocean. To China, however, which claims that wet rock, it looks like a great place to live and totally entitled to a 200-mile exclusive economic zone. And so on and so on. China's ridiculous claims to their rights in the South China Sea have been shown to be ridiculously absurd again and again. And on every single instance of international law, they have been ruled against very thoroughly. And one tribunal in 2016 concluded with this note, and here I'm just going to quote it. Quote, "Any historical right China may have had to the living and non-living resources within the nine-dash line were superseded, as a matter of law and between the Philippines and China, by the limits of the maritime zone provided for by the convention," end quote. And which, as a side note, China has agreed to this convention and is a signatory of it, but apparently feels constrained by it only when it's convenient. The conclusion of the 2016 tribunal goes on to state that, quote, "There is no legal basis for China to claim historic rights to resources within the sea area falling within the nine-dash line," end quote. And during the same international arbitration of the Philippines against China, the Philippines submitted over 170 ancient maps ranging from Chinese sources from the Song, Yuan, Ming, and Qing dynasties, so that's like a thousand-year period, and then post-dynastic China, submitted ancient Philippine maps, maps from various Southeast Asian countries going back hundreds and thousands of years, maps from the European age of exploration and colonization. And collectively, these all paint a very clear picture that no nation, including China itself, considered China to be in control of the South China Sea before the publication of the Nine-Dash Line map in 1947 by a group of Chinese government bureaucrats who baselessly claimed a huge swath of ocean that China never had a historical, legal, or practical claim to. And so all this is the background to the South China Sea dispute. The victory of the Philippines, the International Tribunal, defined in very clear terms that the South China Sea is not Chinese. It is open territory. Immediately, the U.S. Navy, Japanese Navy, Indian Navy, the Australian Navy, the Canadian Navy, the British Royal Navy, the French Navy, and some more navies, they all announced that they would conduct operations to enforce and demonstrate this legally defined freedom by conducting military maneuvers in the area. The next episode is going to go into a whole lot of detail about the U.S. Navy stuff, and we'll go into the freedom of navigation operations and other geopolitical maneuverings that happen around the South China Sea today. I hope that you enjoyed this podcast, despite the distinct lack of U.S. Navy content. And I promise that we're getting back into it. But this is such an important concept and such a important area that's going to define any next conflict, if it happens, knock on wood that it doesn't, that I need to have an episode of background first. But if you're not, next week, I'll have more. So tell your friends, tell your family, tell your shipmates to listen. If you found this episode semi-informative, if you thought it was dreadfully boring, consider telling your enemies to listen to it. If you did like it, though, leave me a review, subscribe so you don't miss the next episode accidentally. And until next time, fair winds and following seas.
Order a military airplane. You are approaching my military security here. Please go away quickly. Order to Ron Gottman. Is it me?
This is calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself. I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Sky. A foreign military airplane, you are approaching my military security air. Please go away quickly in order to run government.
Station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself.
Okay, in order to run government. Read me.
Station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself.
This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Terror Sky. Please go away quickly in order to run government.
I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
Foreign military aircraft, this is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately in order to avoid misjudgment.
I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
U.S. military aircraft, attention. This is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military zone. Please stay away this area and leave immediately. Your action is unfriendly and dangerous.
Station calling U.S. military aircraft, please identify yourself. I'm a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
Go, go!